This program is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL. Tonight on this special Prairie Fire, we'll tell Central Illinois World War II stories. When the USS Indianapolis was sunk by Japanese torpedoes in 1945, there were few survivors. Tonight, we'll hear from three of them who live in Central Illinois: Art Lienerman of Mahomet, Don McCall of Champaign, and Earl Riggins of Oakland. Yuki Llewellyn of Champaign spent the war at Manzanar, where she was interned with her family. She recently returned for the first time since she and her mother left in 1945. Theodore Freeman of Rantoul was on board the USS Missouri when a Japanese kamikaze pilot crashed into the ship. Jill Knappenberger of Champaign served during the Battle of the Bulge. She worked for the Red Cross, driving a refitted truck dubbed a Clubmobile, handing out donuts, coffee, and cigarettes. Sparky Songer of Danville spent 6 months in German camps before escaping and finding his way to American lines. And we'll talk to Iris Nig Lundeen of Champaign, who became one of the first women to teach navigation. Hi, I'm Allison Davis Wood. Welcome to Prairie Fire. Tonight we bring you a special hour-long episode telling Central Illinois World War II stories. More than 90 veterans and their families have been a part of this WILL project, which archives the untold stories from the war. Producer Denise LaGrassa, editor Eleanor Stashiff, and researcher David Noreen spent the last year gathering the memories of many of our neighbors, and we are honored to have this chance to share more of these stories with you. Our first story takes us back to the worst naval disaster in U.S. history. Almost 1,200 men were on board the USS Indianapolis when it was struck by Japanese torpedoes in 1945. Only 317 survived, and three of them live here in Central Illinois. They survived 4.5 days in the water, waiting to be rescued, while battling sharks, cold, and hunger. All of these men were brought up on farms and were accustomed to hard work, long days in the sun, and difficult conditions. Now, looking back, they credit farm life with helping them survive in the Philippine Sea.
When the Navy cruiser, the USS Indianapolis, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine on July 30, 1945, three brave men managed to put on life jackets and jump ship as they prepared to fight for their lives in shark-infested waters. Art Lienerman, Earl Riggins, and Don McCall were among the 1,197 crew members on board in the South Pacific just after midnight at 12:14 a.m.
Well, I'd been on duty that night, supposed to get relieved at 11:45, and got relieved about close to midnight. And I left my station, which was topside, and went back to the head or the John, whatever you want to call it. And I was in there when the ship got hit. Got a life jacket, went back to my general quarters station, and I was there for just a few minutes. And I told this other friend of mine, I said, I think this thing's going to ship. We better get off of here.
I looked in the water, and it was full of guys that didn't have life jackets. And I said, this is wrong. So I put it on. And I jumped, I think, about 60 or 70 feet into the water. But I knew I had to swim away from the ship because the suction of the ship will pull you down if you don't get away from it. And I swam as far as I could and stopped and turned around and watched it go down.
You said you turned back and looked at the ship. You remember how the ship stood straight up in the air when it went down, when it was straight down.
Despite the fact that SOS messages were sent and received, no report was ever filed when the ship failed to arrive on schedule in Leyte on July 31st. The heavy cruiser was returning to the Philippines after delivering components for the atomic bomb.
Next morning, though, we all thought that they'd be looking for us and thought maybe we'd possibly got off an SOS. The radio men thought so. Nobody knew for sure. First day wasn't too alarming. It was when we got around the second day, no one showed up. And the sharks did, though. The sharks got pretty familiar with us.
Sometimes during the daytime and sometimes at night, you could hear airplanes flying over or whatever, but, you know, you can't hardly see anything in the water, so they wouldn't be able to see us at all.
Long days and longer nights, it seemed like, wasn't it?
Well, even Wilbur Gwynn said he couldn't see us in the water at first. He just saw the oil slick.
But before the pilot, Wilbur Gwynn, arrived, these three men and nearly 900 others drifted, prayed, or hallucinated during the five-day wait for rescue. Some men were so dehydrated, they had no choice but to drink the water and pay the price. The salt water sent them to their death.
Well, yeah, a lot of fellows...
They did drink it.
And they'd hallucinate. They come to me, my best friend comes to me the afternoon before the plane spotted us, and said that early, he said, the Indies just under the water, he said, scuttlebutts was the water cooler, still working. He said, the water's good, come on, go with me. And I said, Bob, stay here. And he said, oh, I'm going. I reached out to grab him, and he was gone, and it wasn't long before I heard screams. Now, I'm not saying the sharks got him, but that's the usual thing we heard in screenplays, the sharks, of course.
Art, Earl, and Don endured the constant patrol of hungry predators from dusk to dawn.
The sharks were there, but you're so petrified that, you know, you're just absolutely, you're trying to survive and you're doing everything you can. At first they beat the water. I thought that's not a good idea because that attracts them. So after that I swam away a little bit by myself and I just doubled up in a ball when I see them.
Whenever they decided they were hungry, there wasn't much anything you could do about it.
A lot of the guys, some of them didn't have life jackets and we took life jackets off of some of the dead guys. And
that's when you can see when the
bodies would sink away.
We did the same thing, be just a half body left. And we were saving life, and I'm sure they were too. We were saving life rafts or jackets because some people didn't have them and because life jackets were given out. The older jackets did give out, I think.
They did.
Mine was still, I was not here, but it was still floating me. But.
Struggling in harsh conditions in that same Pacific Sea was the ship's captain, Charles McVeigh III. Though he survived, the captain was court-martialed and convicted of hazarding his ship by failing to zigzag. He was informed his route would be safe. Knowing that another ship sank in that same area the previous week, McVeigh requested an escort ship. His request was denied.
They said that the moonlight was out and I was on watch till midnight, and I'm telling you, it was pitch dark out. There was no moon. After we were in the water for a while, you could see glimpses of it, but it was a dark, gloomy night.
Captain McVeigh had orders that he could zigzag at his own discretion. Well, like Don said, it got dark and it was cloudy that night, and so about 10, 11 o'clock or late that evening, well, they decided to not zigzag anymore, and they just had a straight course. But the ironic thing about the whole thing is the captain asked for an escort at Guam, and they told him he didn't need it. But then after the war was over, we found out that a week before that, a destroyer had got sunk in that same area that we were going through. So somebody out there dropped the ball.
The sinking of the Indianapolis troubled McVeigh for years. In 1968, he committed suicide. Following his death, survivors and others organized a campaign to clear his name. In the year 2000, the captain was finally exonerated by the U.S. Congress. Had McVeigh survived, he would have learned the Navy feared exposure of their most closely guarded secret. They had broken Japan's naval codes. Art, Earl, and Don were among the 317 who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. They believe their strength to survive came from enduring much hardship while growing up on the farm.
My mother had four children. My dad died when I was about 10, and I had to survive by hunting rabbits and picking up coal on a railroad track, and I had a hard time. We raised gardens and chickens and pigs, and that's what kept us alive.
You're working out there on a farm in the sun, and it's 100 degrees in the shade, and you know, you're pitching bundles onto a rack wagon and hauling them to the thrash machine, and you're beating on a pair of old mules trying to keep them going.
I had uncles on the farm, and I spent all summer helping bale hay and you know, the various things, and worked on the farm. You get toughed up to those kind of things.
Those tough times prepared them for the greatest, most heroic challenge of their lives.
People like to call us heroes, and I was an air sea lookout, and I watched the guys land on Tarawa the first time. The heroes are still out there. We're just survivors, and the reason we survived was because we had somebody watching over us.
Yeah, they talk about the football players being heroes or baseball players being heroes. That's far from being heroes. Like Don says, it's those boys that give their lives to this country.
Well, the whole thing about the whole thing is that we survived, and we were able to have a family and grandkids and all these other young guys that didn't survive. They didn't have a chance. When rain has hung the leaves with tears, I want you near to kill my fears. I bet I may as well try and catch the wind.
Yuki Okanaga Llewellyn spent 3 years during World War II interned at the Manzanar Assembly Center in California. In 1942, Llewellyn and her 23-year-old single mother were evacuated from Little Tokyo in Los Angeles to the camp in Lone Pine, California. Her plight was captured by photographer Clem Albers, who took a picture of her sitting on a suitcase in a train station. The photograph became a famous symbol of this chapter in U.S. history. And when she and her mother left Manzanar in 1945, all they had was $25 and two government-issued bus tickets. Llewellyn grew up to become an assistant dean of students at the University of Illinois. And after she retired, she returned to the internment camp for the first time.
There were signs posted on all the lampposts that said, you know, attention, Japanese, Japanese Americans, you are hereby commanded to be at, and then depending on where that poster was posted, you would be given a location. Ours was at Union Station. It was just my mother and me. Hayakawa Okinaga family is how we were listed in the records. The evacuation was, I think, 2 weeks' notice, and we were told that it was just what we could carry. We weren't told where we were going, how long we would be gone. You were even 1/8 Japanese. It included you. There were primarily students who protested and said, hey, I was born in the United States, I'm an American, what happened to due process? And they were promptly jailed. We were all Americans, but it didn't matter. I could see large families getting separated, but everyone had a number and a tag on. When you got on the train, they pulled down all the blinds, so that not only could you not see out, but of course people could not see in. Everyone was sent to an assembly center first. Interestingly, on the records of Manzanar, it said that my family and I arrived in June, when we actually arrived in March. And that was because it was an assembly center from March until June, and then June 1 it became an internment camp. When we got there, barracks were still being built. They put to work all the able-bodied people who were internees to help build the barracks. We shared barracks with other people until the blocks were all formed and the barracks were done. The only thing I can compare it to is horse stalls. Those were kind of the size of all of them. It's just that ours was never a horse stall. They were built. The bathrooms were located centrally, but there were no doors on the stalls. I remember that. And so people would take blankets and hold up blankets for their parents. So if you had to go in the middle of the night, you had to take your blanket holder with you. My mom hated that more than anything, the lack of privacy, the inhumaneness of being treated like that. Mess halls were social centers, because that was when you actually could gather together. They didn't like people meeting, but they had to feed you. People were not eating the white bread and the beans. I guess our people just said, we would like to provide the cooks. Don't bring the white bread, bring sacks of rice, and we will start a garden. So the food was great after the initial introduction to Army food, which we didn't like at all. But my mom and I were not very well-to-do in Little Tokyo, so it was kind of a luxury to know that you were going to get fed three times a day. I was in the elementary school, and I have pictures to prove that I was there. The neat thing about camp to a kid is that you celebrated all the holidays. So we had Christian holidays, Jewish holidays. We had all the fun holidays for kids, even though they weren't Christian. Didn't matter. So we had Santa Claus. We had Easter Bunny. Teachers were whoever was incarcerated. They did have some Quakers who volunteered to come in and teach. And I would say there are a lot of people who were in the camps who would do anything for the Quakers because they volunteered, and we saw them a lot. We were encircled by barbed wire, and there were guard posts with an armed guard in the towers. There was a child who was shot when there was a group of them trying to get outside the barbed wire. So, of course, all the children were told, don't go anywhere near the barbed wire. The suicide rate among the older people was pretty high. They blamed themselves because they were the ones that were from Japan, brought the family over to the United States, and it was because of that that they were being incarcerated. Started leaving camp if they had some place to go, because on the records not only did they put down what day you left the camp, but where you went. My mother and I were by ourselves, and we didn't have any family, so we were one of the last ones to leave. We left in October, and we went to Cleveland, Ohio, because there was a sponsor family there that said, we'll take those two people. Each family was given $25. You have to think in terms of how much that was in 1945, which wasn't a lot, but it wasn't piddly little either as it is today. We met returning GIs on the public transportation. We were, generally speaking, treated fine, and I think it was because of our gender and age, but we were thrown off a train to leave room for soldiers. And I don't think the soldiers asked to have us thrown out. It was just that the people in charge thought that that would be a better use of their vehicle. The redress movement came to a head when it became really clear that our government should not have done this. There were people who lost everything, their family home, land. There's a wonderful song in South Pacific that you have to be taught how to hate. And the opposite is also true. If you celebrated all the holidays like we did and accepted them, nobody would be different.
Next on Prairie Fire, we meet Theodore Freeman, who was a steward serving officers in the mess hall on the USS Missouri. But whenever the enemy struck, he had to man his position on a gun mount and defend the ship. One day, Freeman witnessed a Japanese kamikaze pilot crash into the ship near his post. In our next story, he talks about the challenges he faced as an African-American on board ship and about the conflict between his life as a Pentecostal pastor before Pearl Harbor and his life as a sailor pledged to defend the country.
I was on my way to Sunday school. I was a Pentecostal pastor. I heard them announce that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. At that time, I hadn't been in service, signed up in 43. I know the words say, thou shalt not kill, but I was in war. You do whatever you have to do in order to protect yourself.
Theodore Freeman's role as pastor was put on hold when he decided to take leave and serve his country during World War II. Freeman joined the Navy, went through basic training, and was assigned to the battleship, the USS Missouri. His rank? Steward Mate First Class. At this time, it was the Navy's official policy of enlisting African Americans, primarily for service in the non-white stewards branch.
We served the officers, so we had to make sure that they had their meal. I would set up galley, and we would serve them, each individual.
Stewards serving in the Missouri mess hall were constantly on alert and prepared to fight the enemy.
If they holler, man, regardless of what you're doing, you had to forget that and go man your station, for which I was on a 40 millimeter gun barrel up on a 16 inch mount. Your gun mount moves around, so you got to be able to be swift to move with it.
Moving from the mess hall to the front line during an attack by a Japanese kamikaze pilot remains etched in his memory. This suicide mission was caught on film by Navy Seaman Lynn Schmidt at 2:43 p.m. on April 11th, 1945. The Japanese pilot hit the Missouri, splitting his plane in half just a few feet away from the young Pentecostal preacher.
They sent out a suicide squad. He missed his target, and in missing his target, he hit his 20 millimeter gun barrel, stuck in one of a 40 millimeter gun barrel, and half of him came aboard and one of the wings. He caught on fire. Somebody hollered, put him out. A little holler laid him burned. But they did put him out. The closest I got was these about 2 feet from him. But I knew he couldn't do nothing because he just did have his arms. The other part was going in the water. And we manned our station for a good at least hour or two after then, in case of something else would happen. At times I was scared, and at times I said, well, I'm out here now, so I just have to do the best I can and hope enough to do enough that I can get back without any trouble.
No one died that day except the Japanese pilot. After part of the body was recovered, Captain Callahan held a military funeral aboard the ship. Stirred by his self-sacrificing mission, Callahan believed the kamikaze deserved military honor and respect. Crew members were ordered to wrap the pilot's body and bury it at sea.
America, let us bow our heads in prayer.
To pay tribute to Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
America had lost its legendary leader.
And President Roosevelt passed, and we didn't know how things was going, but we continued to stay tight, ready, and this way we was able to represent him, respecting him, and also giving space and time on the ship. All the crew, I would say, all was sad. They stayed of, you know, silent for sadness for him passing.
Freeman survived the kamikaze attack, the passing of President Roosevelt, and finally, yet another important moment in World War II history was about to take place aboard the Missouri, the monumental signing of the peace treaty with the Japanese, ending World War II.
It was September the 2nd, 1945. General MacArthur, Admiral Halsey, and Chester Lemmets, and as they come forth, they made sure they watch each person go and sign the peace treaty. And then they had the Japanese came and signed. I was able to see everything that went on and see them as they signed the peace treaty. After the war, I came back to the church, then they all greeted me, saluted me. Then from there, I just continued preaching. I took the man along with me, so I didn't have much fear.
Jill Pitts Knappenberger of Champaign was one of three women serving on the front lines during the Battle of the Bulge. She worked for the Red Cross, operating a refitted truck dubbed a Clubmobile. Knappenberger passed out donuts, coffee, and cigarettes to weary soldiers. One of her most trying times during the war was when she was trapped, surrounded by the enemy for 8 days during the Battle of the Bulge. While her brother, John Joseph Pitts III, an Army captain, was in the heat of battle only a few miles away.
Trumpet man from all Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Former American Red Cross volunteer Jill Pitts Knappenberger recalls her service to the military in World War II. From 1943 to 45, Jill drove a 2.5-ton refitted military truck filled with refreshments like coffee, donuts, candy, and music.
Well, they just loved our being there and serving them coffee and donuts. And it was one of the best jobs they ever did because it meant so much to them, and we were doing something that nobody else could do.
Her mission?
We're bringing cheer, mainly, and hometown spirit to these boys, and they were glad from the breaks. They've been on the line in combat, and it's just relaxation. We were working with the greatest people on earth, the American GI.
This traveling symbol of warmth and recreation, known as the Clubmobile, was conceived by Harvey Gibson, commissioner of the American Red Cross in Britain. Mr. Gibson wanted to extend hospitality service to soldiers fighting on the front lines of battle. Women interested in serving as a Red Cross recreation worker had to meet physical and educational requirements. After pre-screening and operations training, the women were sent to brighten the spirits of battle-fatigued soldiers waging war against the Germans.
When they first came up to meet us, it was a joyful thing, cheery. And they'd want to know, where are you from? Oh, so-and-so's from there. And of course, we did have these registers alphabetized by the states. And the GIs, first thing they want was to see that and go to their state and look through there and look for the name of a buddy. And that we quite often did get them together. We had 75 RPM records that we played and a PA system. They loved it. And everybody looked forward to mail. It meant an awful lot. Sometimes the field artillery boys would let us pull the lanyards on the guns that we could shoot the Germans. I've done that more than once. We'd go out to the different divisions with Corps. In the meantime, before we go, we'd make all these thousands of donuts and coffee. And it was a new adventure for us to go where all these different units were, but we never were with any long enough to become close friends. Things were moving pretty fast.
A crew of three Clubmobile girls, as they were known, often traveled with infantry combat units to isolated areas.
Each unit was individual. Ours was the one farthest advanced and got into the most trouble. Helen Anderson, Phyllis McLaughlin, and Jill Pitts. We were the only three women actually caught in the Battle of the Bulge.
Unlike her female counterparts, Jill knew how to drive and repair the heavyweight Clubmobile. Her keen abilities were recognized, and she soon began teaching other Red Cross girls how to drive.
They brought in two girls that had superior driving records, and I was one of them, to teach the new girls coming from the USA how to drive these things.
During a lull between the exchange of enemy fire, Jill traveled to an area where her twin brother Jack, a battery commander with the 106th Army Division, was embedded with his troops. She was planning a party and wanted to introduce Jack to Helen, her friend from the Clubmobile.
That was a Saturday night, December 16th. It was her birthday, and I wanted her to meet my twin brother Jack. See, I had seen Jack just 2 days before. We'd had it all arranged. It was going to be a party that night. Well, that didn't happen. When we got there, we found we were cut off and surrounded. There was very little communication because the enemy had cut the communication lines. There was no ammunition coming in, no food. We were just isolated in this little pocket. We had an assimilated rank of being captain if we were captured. So that was quite a shock, because at that time the field director came up and told me that my twin brother had been killed that morning trying to help some of his men. And that's devastating. But you keep going. It's not like here you're going to go home and cry on your mother's shoulder. You can't do that. And this was part of what we signed up for. We didn't expect it, but we tried to keep people happy there and spread the cheer that we could. And we were there for 8 days before the 82nd Airborne came in. Then they told us to pack a musette, which is a little shoulder bag, with what we wanted to carry out with us. Put an incendiary bomb in the Clubmobile, because we weren't going to have the Krauts have our supplies. In the meantime, the 20th of December, I think it was, we opened our Christmas presents that came from home, because we didn't know if we were going to get them open. And we were prepared to crawl through the lines and just waiting there, and they were to inform us, and then they came back and said one road had been opened briefly and we could drive out. We'd be led out by a Jeep with a colonel and a captain, two GIs. Of course, I did the driving. And I'm following these taillights on this Jeep, not very far behind. And all of a sudden, those taillights disappeared. So I stopped. We walked up the road a little way. And our leading Jeep had run into the back end of 2.5-ton trucks bringing in ammunition. The Jeep was totaled. The colonel was out unconscious on the pavement. And of course, this is the very fine single line of escape, so we had to pick up the colonel and put him in the clubmobile, push the Jeep off the road because we couldn't have it blocked. It's the only road of escape. And put Phyllis and the captain and the two GIs in the back of the clubmobile. There was a great deal of confusion then. Vehicles coming and going. We didn't know where we were to go except to get out of where we were. And we were directed to a forward CP command post and spent the night there. Till they came at 4 o'clock in the morning, get out of here as fast as you can because we've lost the only roadblock between us and the enemy.
After her escape from the Bulge, Jill wrote a letter to her family. With measured words, she carefully concealed the news of her brother's death.
I was sworn by the Army not to mention that he'd been killed because they were to be the first to notify the next of kin. I couldn't mention it for 30 days, so that was one of the worst letters I ever had to write. I could write and say I'd seen him, you know, and I did take some pictures.
As she left Germany at the end of the war with her camera still intact, Jill photographed scenes, morbid scenes of the concentration camps.
We couldn't believe that one human being would treat another human being with such horror. And when I did see the lamp that the commandant's wife had made from the skin of some of the inmates there, and there were piles 4 feet high of just bones. We just couldn't believe. Well, it's almost like you can't believe that what the terrorists did to the Twin Towers.
Let not the defeatists tell us that it is too late. It will never be earlier.
I'm a little one.
Tomorrow will be later than today.
We need more peace.
Our next segment also takes us to the Battle of the Bulge, but this time our story is through the eyes of Sparky Songer of Danville. Songer spent 6 months in German camps before escaping just as the war was winding down. He found his way to American lines thanks to the help of an English-speaking German guard who was a graduate of the University of Michigan. Songer remembers that in the German camps he subsisted entirely on rutabaga soup, and he weighed under 100 pounds when he reached safety. He is now president and curator of the Vermilion County War Museum.
The year was 1943 when Harold G. Songer, president and curator of the Vermilion County War Museum in Danville, was drafted into the U.S. Army. Harold, better known as Sparky, works here as a volunteer. He's a war veteran and lifelong military man committed to providing a place where both the young and old can learn or reflect on war history. Seldom does a day go by when Sparky doesn't recall the bloodiest days of World War II. Surrounded by war memorabilia and dressed in a jacket similar to the one he wore when the Battle of the Bulge broke on December 16, 1944, he recalls the final days of that surprise attack by the Germans in Belgium, deep in the Ardennes forest.
When the Battle of the Bulge opened up, they knocked out our division in 3 days' time. And we fought until we ran out of everything. And Colonel Cavender came up in the morning of the 19th. And I remember very well. And he asked us if we wanted to fight to the finish or surrender. We said we'd fight to the finish because he had no communication from our headquarters. He didn't know what to do either. He said, destroy and tear up your weapons. The rifle, you could pull it back and take the pin out of it and throw it away. But they were gas-loaded cylinder, and he had a clip that went up inside. So you take the clip out and strip the shells out and throw them away. But a lot of the guys forgot about that one in the chamber already there. And during frustration and everything, it'd take with the end of the barrel and slam it up against a tree. And when they did, it was one hell of a commotion, screaming. They'd shoot themselves right through the stomach. So they were dropping. We were yelling. We just had about 6 weeks of infantry training before we went over. My sergeant had just got killed right beside of me. And I hit the ground and I raised my head, and the sniper hit a spoon I had in my pocket. Why I had it, I'll never know, because I had nothing to eat with it. We were just eating K rations at the time. But it bent the spoon, as you can see. That's where it hit. And the lead portion of the bullet dropped in my pocket. And after we surrendered and the Germans searched us, whatnot, they took the lead portion of the bullet, kept it, and gave me back the spoon. It's the only thing I had to eat with when we got in prison camp. After they marched us out of the woods, put us up in the barn lot for the night, and we just stomped all night long trying to keep warm. My feet were so wet and so cold. Everybody was. It wasn't just me. But I found some fence that had been partially tore down. I was going to push it down and make a hammock. Get up on it and stretch out. I felt a gun next to my temple. And I looked over and some guard was screaming at me and made me get down. So I did, as told. But it dawned on me when I was cutting my grass one afternoon. That son of a buck saved my life. I could have laid there on that fence, froze to death. And never have known a thing about it. That's the way you go when you freeze. Next day, they marched us down to some rail line and put us in boxcars. We had to work on a railroad. The railroads were always being bombed, and they shipped in a bunch of railroad ties, and they wanted us to stack them. In doing so, we had to walk to camp. We had nothing for breakfast, had nothing for lunch. We got a little bowl of rutabaga soup in the evening, and that was all. You slept with your clothes, same clothes you worked in. You had no heat in the barracks. You had no running water. You had no facilities. You were fighting the lice. Everybody had it. You had frozen feet. Some was frostbitten so badly that they had to be removed. On Christmas Eve, they took us into Stalag 4B. You had to do exactly as they told you. They didn't particularly care where you lived or died. In my case, a German guard who thought that I had taken his briefcase and possibly his sandwich, I had nothing to do with it. But the Czech guard who was with him told him that he had hit it, and they both laughed after beating me, almost breaking my back. Needless to say, I had to go back to work like the rest of them. And consequently, over the years, I've had 4 back operations, 2 fusions. So things don't go away. You live with them daily. They put us on more trains, and while I was unloading my portion of the coal car, a German guard, well, he was down looking under these coal boxcars, and I got down and I was looking, and the guards kept saying, "Defueler." I could see a figure in the porthole. It looked like Hitler. After that, we were notified by our guards that the Russians were coming in, which we knew. They'd ask us if we had anything we wanted to send to the laundry, and they'd have it back to us that evening. They wanted to make us look clean and presentable. We were totally exhausted. We said we'd stay here in the barn tonight. We could hear the Russians coming in. They were dropping bombs. So the next morning, another fellow, and I always thought his name was Lamb from Mississippi, but I'm not sure. Him and I just opened up the barn door because we got up before everybody else, I guess, and looked out on the hillside, and there was a young German officer there with a pair of binoculars watching the Russians blow up Dresden. We just walked over to him and nonchalantly, and I said, "Americana das way, ja," and that's much German as I remember. He says, "Yeah, about 140 miles. It's a long way to Tipperary, isn't it?" I said, "You speak English?" "Yes, I went to University of Michigan, and I came over to visit my family, and I got drafted in." He said, "Just go through the woods. Don't get on the highway." And he says, "About 140 miles. Good luck." And says, "See you." So we just kept on walking.
Next on Prairie Fire, we continue our Central Illinois World War II special by visiting with Ira Snig-Lundin of Champaign. When the war broke out, she left her small hometown in Minnesota and joined hundreds of other women in the newly formed Marine Corps Women's Reserve. Then, this former school teacher became one of the country's first female navigation instructors.
Fasten your seatbelts.
When I was teaching navigation,
I had this class of 13 young men, and they were wonderful.
Come fly with me, we'll fly away.
And during when you were doing this, you were always meeting pilots who had already been flying, mostly in the South Pacific.
Come fly with me, we'll fly away.
Met one young man who had spent a week on a raft. They had been on, you know, hell of mission. There was no sweet life anywhere where they were.
Iris Nig Lundin taught navigation to some of the brightest and bravest airmen in World War II. Among the greats was a group of men under the command of legendary aviator Major Gregory Pappy Boyington. Pappy Boyington and his crew shot down over 90 Japanese planes. In between missions, Iris helped his men prepare to find their way through the bloodiest of battles.
Pappy Boyington was working with mostly tremendous, tremendous fighter pilots, because they were in the middle of every hot battle, I think, that there was. And, of course, they lived for the minute.
Throughout her service, Iris played a unique role in the history of the Marine Corps Women's Reserve.
I was very fortunate in that I ended up as one of the first four women navigators in the Marine Corps. These are my wings. I never wore them on base because, to the ordinary observer, they looked like pilot's wings. And I thought, I'm not going through what the pilots are doing at all. When I was off base, I wanted to brag about what the women were doing. So I wore them, and so I'm saying, are you a pilot? So I could tell them what we were doing. You know, that's not bragging about yourself. That's bragging about a bunch of people.
Iris marched in lockstep Marine Corps history with her pioneer predecessor, Offa Mae Johnson. Johnson enlisted in World War I, along with 304 others, in the Marine Corps Women's Reserve. At this time, their work was confined to mostly clerical duties. Some served as cooks, others as nurses. After the war, Major General Commandant George Barnett issued orders for the separation of women from the Marines. It wasn't until February of 1943 when the official announcement to recruit women was made by Major General Commandant Thomas Holcomb. Major General Holcomb approved the new formation of the Marine Corps Women's Reserve. Thousands of combat casualties across the globe made the recruitment of women in all branches of the armed services a wartime necessity. School teachers like Iris were losing interest in their work and were willing to join.
I had been teaching for 2 years, and I was working that summer in Minneapolis and had a little altercation with the place where I was working, and I thought, I'm not going to work here, I'm going to go in the Marine Corps. So I walked to the recruiting center and went in. My parents didn't know, I didn't tell anybody, even the man that I ended up marrying, I didn't tell him.
She signed up and took a troop train with hundreds of women from Minneapolis to North Carolina. Sitting near her on that same train was a famous athlete who was paving the way for women in golf.
Patty Berg, the first woman golfer ever made newspaper, was on that train also.
After basic training, she attended officers' training, then navigation instruction. Navigation classes were held late at night, leaving almost no time for R&R.
We went to school from midnight until 8 o'clock in the morning, and that was pretty bad because you thought you had to live during the daytime, but you also had to go to class at midnight and have your wits about you.
Navigation students were training in airplanes that were not always in the best condition. Good planes were in short supply because they were needed in combat. Consequently, students like Iris had to make do whenever she could.
I looked out and there was flame coming out of that engine, and I thought, oh man, we're on fire. The fellow sitting beside me, oh, don't worry, it's okay. They were not the best quality planes because they were the remnants of what was needed for fighting. One day we went out and there was a ship standing on its head. It had been sunk. I met a man shortly after that who was in security. And he said, not many people know that within 7 miles of the U.S. coast, we have German submarines. So apparently the boat that we saw that was sunk that one day had been sunk overnight. Never made the papers, he said. Nobody ever knows that because people in the U.S. would panic if they knew that subs were that close. I think you just sort of lived scared all the time.
As a female teacher of male students, Iris says she was always treated fairly and respectfully.
There was never anybody who misbehaved. Not ever. You know, even out on night once, it was pretty dark, and you were looking at the stars, nobody tried to get fresh at all.
She did, however, witness race discrimination on base. On one occasion in the mess hall, she disagreed with a comment made by a higher-ranking officer, and she let him know it.
I have never been discriminatory, and I thought one day I was going to get chopped down in rank because we were at the senior mess hall at noon, and there was one smart-apple fellow officer, much higher in rank than I was, and he made this smart remark to this young black steward. And it made me so mad, and I just said to him, he probably has more education than any of us put together. And I got up and left the table. And after I got away, I thought, I wonder what's going to happen to me tomorrow. But nothing did.
When World War II ended in August of 1945, Iris witnessed another war looming on the home front. America's history of racism continued, despite the fact that black military men and women bravely served their country. As she boarded the bus leaving for Minnesota, Iris reflected on the heartless remarks and ridiculous systems of racial separation, a system that she says still finds its way into modern thinking over 60 years later.
When they called the bus, I went out, and they said, I got in the wrong place because I went to the back of the bus, and they said, you can't sit here. And I had noticed that they were black-only and white-only restroom areas and fountains and everything, and I never cared what color you were if you behaved. But I had to move. They wouldn't let me sit in the back of the bus. They thought that because your skin was dark, you weren't smart. It takes people, well, there are a lot of rednecks yet, you know that. I'm sure that there are some in my acquaintance. It's too bad because when you have to fight for skin color, that's ridiculous. But keep on carrying the cross, I guess, and that's it. And eventually people will learn.
Thanks for joining us tonight for this special Prairie Fire. WILL salutes all the men and women who served our country during the trying times of World War II. We are thankful we've been able to play a small part in preserving their stories for future generations. All those who lived during this time, whether on the battleground or in the home front, are truly heroes. If you have any comments or suggestions for Prairie Fire, you can email us at willprairiefire@gmail.com. To read more about the stories in tonight's show, or to watch any of the stories again, visit our website at will.illinois.edu. I'm Allison Davis Wood, and I'll see you next time on Prairie Fire.
I said, well, is it okay if this was my block, this was my barracks, could I take a sample of the dirt? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. He says, do you have something, you know, to put the dirt in? I said, yeah, I brought a baggie with me. And he looked at that and had a fit of laughter. So when I take people, groups of people, especially with children, to a tour, like I'm giving you a tour right now, he said, I ask kids if they know about Scooby-Doo. And they all do. They know Scooby-Doo. Great Dane dog with the funny knees. And he said, the person who created Scooby-Doo lived in Manzanar for 3 years. He was 13 when he came to Manzanar.